Now, time to look at some of the biggest political stories of the day. At 10:20, joining us is Josh Lowe over at Newsweek. Hello, Josh. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi there.
Hi there. Not strictly political news, but the palace has announced today that Prince Philip will step back from public life later on this autumn. And I wonder if you have any reaction to that.
Well, I think for anyone who enjoys watching royal news, it'll be a bit of a disappointment, really. He was always one of the more colourful characters in the royal family. You can remember right back to 1969 when he offended Tom Jones by saying it's very difficult at all to see how it's possible to become immensely valuable by singing what I think are the most hideous songs. Right the way through to 2011, when on approaching his 90th birthday, he warned the public that bits are beginning to drop off. So he's always a kind of colourful public figure. And I think, anyone who sort of follows royal news will probably miss a bit of that unpredictable edge that he brought to proceedings.
Yeah, it was only yesterday he said that he was the world's most expensive plaque unveiler, something like that. let's look at the French elections this morning. Marine Le Pen and Emmanuel Macron have clashed in a TV debate ahead of Sunday's vote. Some strong stuff in TV coverage overnight. What did both parties have to say, Josh?
I thought that one of the most interesting lines was from Marine Le Pen, who got in a kind of a gag where she said that whoever wins the election on Sunday, a woman will be running France. It'll either be me or Mrs. Merkel, which is a reference to the idea that Emmanuel Macron will be much too close to Germany, much too kind of internationalist. And that really gets to the heart of what this choice is about. They really are offering a very stark difference. Marine Le Pen, all about closing the borders, pulling up the protections on the economy. Macron, much more about being very engaged abroad and engaged in the EU. Anyone who watched the debate will have found it sort of difficult to probably establish a clear winner in their own mind. It was a lot of kind of scrapping, a lot of back and forth, a lot of sniping at each other. The polls do suggest that the public overall found Macron more convincing. About 63% of French said that they thought he did better out of it.
Okay, so that's the general opinion on who came out on top. What about the favourite going into Sunday's vote, Josh?
Well, I think it seems pretty clear that unless there's a big upset, Macron is sort of keeping his lead solid. He was on about a 25-point lead in the polls. That narrowed over the first week since the first round to about a 20-point lead. But over the last few days, that 20-point lead has remained solid. The polls for the first round of voting were accurate, so there's no reason to think that these polls aren't accurate, which would mean that we're looking at a result of about 60-40, a solid win for Macron. But, of course, it shouldn't be downplayed that is a remarkable result for the National Front as well. The last time they were in a presidential election second round, they got just 18% of the vote. So if Marine Le Pen does indeed get 40 or above, they have really grown their influence in French politics, and they're not a force that can be ignored after Sunday.
Okay, Josh, moving away from the elections, the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, says it was wrong to suggest Brexit would be a fast and painless process with no impact on people's lives. He's highlighted the rights of EU citizens, the final divorce settlement and the Irish border question as the key issues that must be addressed. What exactly did he say?
Well, he was just spelling out the commission, the EU commission, who are going to be running the negotiations. He was spelling out their kind of negotiating guidelines. None of it was a huge surprise, but what it did do was sort of hammer home how big the gaps are between London's position and Brussels' position on some issues. Take, for example, the rights of EU citizens. Now, London's view, firstly, it should be said that both sides want to guarantee the rights of EU citizens to stay in the UK, but London's view is that that can be done very quickly and just got out of the way with a kind of quick handshake saying, right, you can all stay and let's move on. Brussels are making it clear that they see that as a much more complex issue. What needs to be decided are whether family members of people who are currently here can come over after Brexit, whether people who are currently here can leave and come back again after Brexit, what benefits they have access to, all of these thorny issues. And most controversially, Brussels confirmed yesterday that it wants the European Court of Justice, the ECJ, to have jurisdiction over the rights of those EU citizens in Britain. Now, that is a long way from London's position, where, of course, we remember well, Theresa May has told us that the ECJ is going to have no power over Britain after Brexit. So that's going to be a really sort of tough obstacle to get over early in the talks.
Were you expecting him, or was anybody expecting him, to take quite so tough a stance on these subjects?
Well, I think the short answer is yes. I mean, remember, this is a negotiation with two sides. This isn't Britain with its people and its democratic mandate negotiating with a sort of dusty bureaucracy. It is partly that, of course. There's plenty of dusty bureaucrats in Brussels, but there are also 27 European electorates, and their interests need to be represented by Brussels. Public opinion in, say, Poland is going to be very strongly on the side of making sure that EU citizens' rights, to go back to that issue we just talked about, are very strongly protected. And they're going to want Brussels to be pushing for the hardest line possible on that. So I think there's been a bit of a sense where we in Britain have forgotten that there are two democratic sides to this negotiation. And that's why there's going to be a real kind of clash of wills.
So what happens next?
Well, there's a bit more technical stuff to sort out. What was announced yesterday was technically just a draft negotiating guidelines. Those then need to be approved by the leaders of the remaining 27 EU countries, but they probably will, or at least in large bulk. And that will mean that Brussels will be ready to get going in the next few weeks. They will, of course, have to wait for the result of our general election on June the 8th. But if, as we imagine, Theresa May ends up victorious in that, then from June the 8th or 9th, Theresa May can head back into Brussels and they can start hammering things out. And then, of course, we have a two-year negotiating process until 2019.
And finally, Josh, the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, has rejected reports that the UK could be asked to pay as much as €100 billion. That's £84.5 billion as part of its divorce settlement with the European Union. I wonder, is this significantly higher than previous estimates?
It is higher. Most of the estimates have put it at more like 50, 60 billion. But I think what's notable is that whatever the final figure comes out as being, we haven't seen any strong denial from London that we will pay something. This is basically, it's being described as a sort of divorce bill, but it's really more of a sort of pay up what you've already agreed to pay kind of thing. We've already bought into various EU schemes and programs. We've already played our part in the EU budget up to 2020. And the debate is really just over how much of that we're still responsible for and what the final figure comes out as. I suspect, as in any negotiation, you'll see bits chipped off either side and we'll come out with a figure sort of somewhere in the middle, somewhere maybe more like 70, 80 billion. But it does look like we're probably going to have to pay something.
It's useful perhaps reminding people why this fee is payable. And could we refuse to pay it at all?
Well, it's payable because Britain, as a member of the EU, made various financial commitments. The current budget, which goes up to 2020, was decided a couple of years ago, long before we ever knew we were going to be leaving. So we obviously sort of signed off on all of that. It also, we're obviously part of various European institutions and bodies. We contribute to their funding, you know, science agencies, Europol, all sorts of things like that. And we need to decide of those that we're leaving out of them, which we still owe some money for. So that's why we need to pay some kind of money. And in terms of whether we could refuse, I mean, that's a legal debate. I mean, it is probably legally possible for Britain to just walk, because there is, you know, if we leave the ECJ's jurisdiction, the EU couldn't necessarily force us to pay. But if we were to do that, it'd be very unlikely that we'd get anything out of Brussels that we want. That would be an extremely aggressive move.
Yeah, it would be indeed. Josh Lowe, thank you very much indeed. Reporter over at Newsweek joining us for the politics stories of the morning. Just a reminder that voting is ongoing in the local elections across the UK today and in certain mayoral elections as well.